our podcast this week, we bend the Fass's ear about his new video game adaptation, Assassin's Creed, and ask ourselves, which is the greatest of all Christmas movies? Is it Bellatar's Santa Tango or Armando Olmi's The Christmas Tree of Wooden Clogs? Hello, Pod. As you might have gathered, I'm not Chris Hewitt. He's away bringing goodwill and saucy innuendo to all mankind. I'm Phil Desemlian with another one of my art house takeovers, which means expect this to take at least 7 hours and involve four or five references to Berlin Alexanderplatz, for which I'm not going to apologise. This week I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is a man who's such a big fan of James Cameron, he's releasing himself in special edition next year. It's James Dyer.
Hi, Phil.
Hi. You aren't releasing yourself in special edition. I don't even know what that means.
I'm not, no, but I'm going to eat a carob pie in his honour.
Are you? Okay. Mm. If you did release yourself in special edition, you'd prefer the original?
I would. I would prefer to eject the 17 minutes I would subsequently add. So it'd be like a special edition and then a director's cut, which went back from the special edition to the theatrical.
But that might be important James Dyer backstory for the rest of us.
It could.
To understand where you came from, what happened.
It could, yeah.
The origin.
What happened in my life to bring me to such a low ebb that I'm sitting here with you today?
So the Empire Podcast stroke therapy session continues with our second... you're not really a guest. Guest isn't the word, is it? Guest. Our second guest this week is a true Empire great. It's an honour and a privilege to have him back on the podcast. He is a man with the great and good of Hollywood on his Christmas card list, and a man who didn't celebrate Steven Spielberg's 70th birthday this weekend. Steven Spielberg's 70th birthday celebrated him. It's Ian Freer.
Hello, Phil.
Hi, Ian.
How you doing, man?
Good, I'm really well. How are you?
Yes. So Steven Spielberg turned 70 on December 18th.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got him vouchers.
What for?
Well, just...
Like Zabby.
Yeah, exactly.
You get Minority Report on Blu-ray.
Yeah, you can, yeah.
It's all on sale this time of year.
Yeah, he's broken his foot. He's on crutches. If people saw online, he was at Kirk Douglas' 100th birthday party on crutches.
Was he?
I don't know what he's done, but we wish him well.
That's terrible.
Do you think he got caught in a door while visiting the set of Episode 8?
No, I think he can go to anywhere he likes on the set of Episode 8. He went everywhere he liked on the set of Episode 7, so I'm sure he can do the same with Episode 8.
He's got a lot of films to make, so we wish him a speedy recovery.
Yes.
Get back out there. Shall we have a question?
Go for it.
To get cracking from one of our lovely readers. This is from Carl Anders, who goes by the Twitter handle @Lestrade. I want to get rid of the in-laws pretty soon after Christmas dinner. What's the least appropriate Christmas movie to show?
Well, I don't know about least appropriate, but terrible is I'm a big fan of those Christmas films that end up on Channel 5 in the afternoon. And the dear of these, the worst and therefore the best of them, is Mrs. Miracle, which stars James Van Der Beek as a kind of a single parent whose wife has died and he's bringing up his kids. And an older woman comes into his life and kind of magically finds romance for him. It's absolutely terrible, dreadful.
The older woman finds her. She's not the love interest.
No, she's not. No,
she's like a matchmaker.
Yes, and she finds a lonely travel agent who's too busy for work to find love. So she hooks him up with James Van Der Beek.
So she's like a human Tinder.
Yes, she is. That's exactly what she is.
Swipe your wand left.
But it's that genre in particular. If you're being freelance, I'm home in the afternoons, and you kind of see these Channel 5 Christmas movies, and there's tons of them. They absolutely peddle them out. So it's I show that whole genre to people.
Films that Tom Hanks turned down.
Not even Tom Hanks.
No.
Steve Guttenberg turned
these films
down. Yeah. Steve Guttenberg turned these films down. And they're fascinating viewing. They're absolutely fascinating.
Okay.
There's a lot of death. And it's interesting. One of the films we're talking about for review this week could well fit into this genre.
Interesting.
Which we'll come to.
Starring Steve Guttenberg.
Yes.
Krampus might do it. Not because it's bad, it's brilliant. But, I mean, if your in-laws are not into, you know, being... Actually, I was about to spoil the end of the film. I'm not going to do that. Evil Santa Claus. That might do it. Or Love Actually. Now I love Love Actually. I know I'm on a limb there, as does Empire's editor Terry White. But it's so morally repugnant to a great many people that
I just think it's fascinating, the hatred that film evokes. To me, it seems such a benign thing.
Well, it's Andrew Lincoln, isn't it? It's the whole Andrew Lincoln, Keira Knightley, Chiwetel Ejiofor really wrong love triangle that really gets people's goat.
That's the whole thing, that that sparks people off? Just that one thing?
Because it's, the way he reacts is awful, and then the way she reacts to him is awful, and it's just, I mean, I love the film, but even I can see that's
as wrong. Everybody always says, Emma Thompson is brilliant in that movie.
She is brilliant.
So that cancels it out, doesn't it? So we're all good.
She might be the only one, but she is.
This happens every day at Christmas at Empire, doesn't it? Like, somebody mentions Love Actually, and then within 20 minutes, there's people just clawing each other's eyes out.
I love Love Actually.
Spirit of Christmas. Debate. Mm. Heated debate.
What about you, Phil? What Iranian drama would you put on?
Well, you
Christmas?
Laugh. I think this has been raised before, but there was a Christmas not too many years ago when I did actually put on The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant in the spirit of improving cinema. And that drove, never mind the in-laws, the family, the whole lot of them.
Everyone left
pretty
them
much there. Out. Wow. Of the house.
It's almost hard to believe.
Into the snowy wilds.
Yeah, I did that once. For Christmas, I got a copy of the, on vinyl, so long ago this was, of the Draftsman's Contract soundtrack.
Ooh.
By Michael
Nyman.
Nyman,
right.
And I made my family listen to it on Christmas Day in the evening. And, you know, I'm kind of excommunicated ever since. Never been
Is it quite? Is that quite a jarring audio feast?
Yeah, it is. The last track is a 12-minute dirge.
Oh, great.
So I have very indulgent parents.
Okay. I guess the Shane Black, depending on your in-laws, I think I'm right in saying that none of us have in-laws, and we won't be experiencing this situation firsthand, but in-laws coming around on Christmas Day. But I would imagine that maybe some of the Shane Black films might, if you really want to drive them away.
Oh, you wouldn't drive anyone away with that.
I don't know. If they're anything, I don't know, if they've got conservative taste.
Imagine Iron Man 3, you're not going to drive anyone away. Kiss, kiss, bang, bang.
I just think if you want to get rid of them, Irreversible.
Well, yeah, it's nothing to do with Christmas, but damn.
No, do it.
That'd do the trick.
If you're having Christmas problems, Gaspar Noé. Every time.
There you go. Yeah. There's your answer. Yeah, just put baubles around the telly.
And a bit of art house stuff for Phil there.
But has anyone, you know, have you seen the meme with the Christmas hat? Is this a thing you've seen?
No. What's
no?
that?
No,
it's
what
like
is it?
A drinking game meme where so you get a Christmas hat and you put it on the corner of the telly, and every time action happens in a film which syncs up with a person on screen so it looks like they're wearing the hat, you have to have a drink. So it's that very specific particular shot where they're in the very corner of the frame looking into, like, away from the camera and to the side, so it looks like they're wearing the hat.
That has got to be very precise, hasn't it?
It has got to be quite precise, and I imagine there's a lot of margin for error. But that's a thing you could do with your family, because there'd probably be an A&E after a while.
That's incredibly specific.
It is.
I've never heard of that.
Well, this is the internet for you. This is the shit that goes on.
Okay. I'll give that a whirl too. Remember, if you'd like to have a question read out on the Empire podcast, usually as a preamble to about 20 minutes of mindless jibber jabber, please get in touch with us via Twitter at the hashtag Empire Podcast, or you can message us on Facebook. Username is Empire Magazine, or email us at podcast@empireonline.com. Right, should we have some filmic news?
Fantastic.
All trailers. Right.
There's a lot of trailers.
All about the trailers this week, and it all happened during the Empire Christmas party. So we left the office of an afternoon and went and did a weird mystery game thing, but the less said about that, the better. And during that time, not only did the John Wick 2 trailer drop, but also the first Blade Runner trailer.
Yeah, which is terrific.
And they were both awesome.
Yeah, I went to the... there was a press screening of Passengers on Monday night. And before it, they showed the Blade Runner trailer.
Did people lose their shit?
On the big screen, on the IMAX side screen.
Ooh.
That's terrific. It's absolutely terrific.
See, it feels like Blade Runner, just like the look, the costume
design.
Yeah, but
it feels a little different as well.
It has its own identity.
Feel like a slavish
retread. It feels time has passed, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it has the Vangelis in there, that kind of, you know, feeling to it. But here's the thing. I'm less excited that it's Blade Runner and more excited that it's just Denis Villeneuve. Is that weird?
No.
Like, he excites me more than the fact that it's a Blade Runner film.
I thought it was an interesting choice to start with some of Ford's voiceover, which is so maligned
in
certain quarters. Yeah, we'll start with that and see how
Don't
that
start
goes.
It, but it won't be in the final cut of the film.
No.
Have you seen Encendies yet?
I haven't.
I just like saying the name
of
the film.
You do like saying it.
I really like saying
Encendies.
Encendies is still his best film.
It's a great film.
That's the same one I haven't seen.
Blistering film. But you're right, he is just knocking him out of the park.
Put a foot wrong.
So John, why don't you tell us about what you thought of John Wick 2?
Oh, I loved it. It was a rip-roaring rampage of revenge. Yeah, I mean, look, Phil's screwing up his face. You've got your... This is like Dan Jolin's not on the podcast. You are assuming the mantle of Dan in this case.
Oh,
Dan, hater of kind of vigilante porn.
Yes.
Hater of Death
it's
Wish
Death
taken.
It's Death Wish for twats.
Equalizer. It's not. It's Death Wish for champions. It's amazing. It's got gun fu. It's got amazing action. He's this larger-than-life, brilliant persona. It's got a dog, and the dog, you know, seems to be alive, and that's good. No, I loved it, because I've...
I was on set
for one of the sequences.
What did you
which
see?
You see in the trailer, which is the Hall of Mirrors sequence.
Okay.
Which is quite exciting. I'm a big fan of John Wick and very, very excited about this film. And you got to see a lot more in this trailer than you did in the first one. So the idea is that, you know, obviously he's come out of retirement at the end of the first film. He's approached to do a job and he says no, and it goes badly for him. I like the idea, you know, we're going to open an account. That account is John Wick. And it's that really interesting idea that all the assassins in the world are now going to try and kill John Wick. And he's clearly going to kill all of them. It's going to be amazing. And that sequence between him and Common is like, are you here on business? He's like, I'm afraid so.
I love this.
Cool.
James is acting out trailers for us. Next up is the emoji trailer.
Yeah, right.
The emoji movie trailer. Do you want to try that one?
Yeah. How do I contort my features into the poo emoji? I didn't watch the emoji trailer, I'll be honest with you, but I suspect it will be tongue out, eyes closed, praise hands, Christmas tree, poo.
Well, it was a bold... No, I did watch it. It was a bold gambit, because everybody's obviously approaching this film with a sense of deep trepidation, and they've gone with the Met emoji as their kind of... with a really...
How ironic.
With a really downbeat kind of voiceover, and that's sort of playing into what everybody's assuming of the film as it stands.
Can you tell me what the film's about?
No, I've got a clue.
Does anyone know?
No, I don't
know. It looks... I mean, you can't tell much from the teaser, but it looks a bit like a kind of... they're kind of like Monsters, Inc.-y type of characters.
But, I mean, is this, in fact, something that we've not seen coming? And really, it's a really sort of nasty, gritty serial killer film where the killer leaves emojis on every body, like burned into their flesh or something, and that's the film, and no one realises.
What, with, like, the water pistol?
Possibly.
Using that John Wick style.
Yeah, and it's like the clues he leaves are emojis at every crime scene.
An emoji-sploitation movie.
Yeah.
It's hard to say at this point. It didn't look like it from a distance.
Yeah, I think so.
But maybe the full-blown trailer will be an orgy of bloodletting.
Yeah, like Seven, but with more smiley faces.
It will literally make you poo emoji yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's very hard to say. They're keeping their whatever they've got under their sleeves, under wraps, for the time being. Right. I don't know. It does look like the sort of coming apocalypse from a distance, but I guess we have to wait and see.
Here's the thing. How is it that emojis have suddenly become socially acceptable, but emoticons are somehow frowned upon? Like, there's snobbery in the kind of smiley face grammar of punctuating text messages.
I don't know. That's a very good question.
Yeah,
is there still snobbery, or is that just in your house?
No, no. I'm fairly certain.
Really,
this is the thing. Like, people like look down. If you do the little colon bracket smiley face thing, you're a twat. But if you do a proper emoji, somehow, you're being terribly millennial and conversational and expressing emotion through. And it's like so much so that my phone tries to force me to use emojis when I'm typing, because it suggests emojis as autocorrect.
I'm not sure that's just your phone.
Like, if you write house, it gives you a little picture. Oh, thanks, because I didn't know what a house looked like. Brilliant. Why don't I delete the word that I've just painstakingly typed to put in this stupid picture instead?
Phil's phone has got an Ingmar Bergman emoji. It's like a Grim Reaper.
Or
a chess piece.
Every time you type the seventh seal, it just replaces it with a pause.
Seven seals.
At the end of each text message is 17 lines of just blankness, just to represent the existential state of man.
Wow. What is the nihilism emoji?
The nihilism emoji is... what would that be? What would that be?
Just a gaping void.
There is the Munch one, isn't there? There's the one where...
Oh, the scream.
Yeah, the scream. So I use that quite a lot.
I can well imagine.
Instead of kisses.
Yeah. You end your text with a scream. Wow.
More news. Dick Van Dyke.
Yes.
Dick Van Dyke. Dick
All right,
Van
Governor.
Is he here?
What?
Is he in the room? Yes, he's joining the cast of the Mary Poppins.
Yes.
Reboot?
Updates? Reloaded.
Reloaded? Mary Poppins
Reloaded. Mary Poppins Revolutions.
Yeah, he is.
With Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda, isn't it?
Yes. Although Dick Van Dyke called him that guy from Hamilton, because he's sort of forgotten. But
do we know? Is he reprising his role? Do we know?
I believe he is making an appearance as Bert.
Okay.
So this is one. This is where Bert's aged and Mary Poppins is immortal. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah.
Let me read out what we have.
She's like the Wolverine of nannies.
So, yes, Dick Van Dyke says this one supposedly takes place 20 years later and the kids are all grown up. He has said that he's going to be in London in the spring to do his role and he gets to do a little song and dance number. That's all we know.
Well, there we
Great.
Go.
Great.
I don't With think or without penguins, that's to be decided.
Yeah.
Are we excited about this film? Are we going to just...
The film, yeah, definitely, yeah.
Again, I'm not
Emily
convinced.
Bunce. Emily Blunt's great.
Yeah, I'm not convinced this isn't another horror film as well. You know, like it's an abduction. A bit like Prisoners.
You've seen the,
while we're on
you've seen the Mary Poppins trailer recut as a horror film. Have you seen that?
I didn't think it needed recutting. Didn't she appear on our list of the greatest villains? This is, you know,
yeah, that was
this
just,
is a thing.
That was controversial, wasn't it?
Possibly slightly.
And James Franco joins... What do we know what tense to approach it? Because Alien Covenant is now wrapped.
Yeah, and it's like he joins, presumably joined before it's shot.
So they've just announced the fact that he's in the film.
Or it's a prank, and they've got him along, but they've like, we finished.
It's like an elaborate ruse.
Right. Didn't you guys see 10 minutes of it?
We did. Yes, I did.
Did you?
How was that?
I saw a bunch of it. I can't remember what I'm allowed to say, so I'm not going to go into any details lest I be murderised by Fox. But yes, it was very interesting. It was very interesting. There was blood, I will tell you that.
Okay.
There was blood and the deading of people.
Okay.
Mm. And the tone?
Were there aliens in it? Are you allowed to say that?
There were things in it that were not entirely human. That's the extent of what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Lest the eye of Sauron turn upon me and burst into flames. Yes, interesting times. Interesting times. It's a curious one. I was a Prometheus apologist. I really enjoyed Prometheus. So, I'm very much looking forward to this. I know a lot of people didn't.
You're wrong about so many things today,
as we will discover to greater extent later on. But yes. So it would seem. But no, Prometheus was interesting. It was a good as a kind of standalone hard sci-fi film. I thought it had a lot to commend it. What I didn't think it worked as was as a part of the Alien franchise. So if you take it out of that, I think it works well. This one feels more rooted in the Alien franchise, so it may be the Prometheus that people wanted from Prometheus, if that makes sense.
Very good.
That sounds like something I'd like to see.
Yeah.
I definitely did not want to see a Prometheus 2, so that's all to the good.
Okay.
Some box office news. We don't normally get our calculators out here, but it's worth mentioning, unsurprisingly, despite the boycott Rogue One, Star Wars nonsense, that Rogue One has made a shit ton of cash. In its first weekend in the entire world, actually.
Do we know what's its worldwide gross at the moment?
It's just under 300 million US as of sort of its first week, basically. So we're looking at, I think Disney's looking at a $7 billion year, which is...
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So if they don't bring us all individually presents this year, then something's gone awry. But I think slightly more interesting is the Great Wall story. Was he Zhang Yimou's new martial art wushu?
It's Lord of the Rings, kind of Lord of the Rings type
Walls.
Fantasy with Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
So it's a kind of, it's got an eye on all markets, isn't it? It's got an eye on the American market and it's got an eye on the Chinese market.
Yeah. Can you have more than four quadrants? I suppose not. But it's like double four quadrants.
It's many, many quadrants. Do they use ladders to climb the wall?
I haven't seen the film.
Could it be Lord of the Rungs?
Oh, very good. Very good.
That's actually too bad. That's made 60 million US, I think, in China in its opening, which would, I guess, I mean, this seems to be a grand cinematic experiment in terms of what a US star can do in China and what China can do over here. So,
yeah. With those kind of results, it'll be the future, I think. There'll be more of this.
Yeah. It looks that way.
And it opens in UK in February 17th, I think.
Good to know. And lastly, if you are in the, I think the Chicago area, you will be able to visit Bill Murray's new Caddyshack restaurant.
What's that?
Which is probably the big cinematic news of the week.
It's called Caddyshack.
The Murray, because Bill Murray's not the only Murray, there's several brothers.
Okay.
They have set up a restaurant called Caddyshack in World Golf Village in St. Augustine, Florida. So that's absolutely nowhere near Chicago. if you've got access to a Chicago airport and you can fly down to Florida, you can visit it. It's open 7 days a week. This is a massive plug for Bill Murray's new restaurant. On the menu, there is no gopher, confit of gopher, unfortunately. But it looks like he's got some basically delicious American-style food and pizzas with a...
A picture of the gopher on the menu.
A picture of the gopher on the menu. So for the Caddy Shack hardcore aficionado.
Are you surprised there's not like a cantina restaurant?
Well
you can
go
and eat with, you know, Phil Grindan and Modal Nodes playing in the background.
Ponda Barber harasses you at the bar.
All that kind of experience.
Well, the closest thing they ever had was, did you go to the Secret Cinema Empire Strikes Back?
I didn't, no.
Well, the Secret Cinema Empire Strikes Back, which they did down in, where was it? It was in the East End somewhere, in this big warehouse thing, where, incidentally, they shot sequences from Avengers Age of Ultron. Just throwing that out there. Okay. They had a replica of the cantina there.
Right.
You could not buy blue milk, because I asked.
Right.
They did have beer, which I don't recall being on the menu in the cantina in the film.
Yeah.
But yeah, they'd kind of recreated it quite well, and lots of people were kind of cosplaying in there as the different characters and stuff, and they had the music playing on a loop. It was kind of...
why isn't that a franchise? Or I guess when you go to Star Wars World in Disney, that would be a...
Almost certainly. Like, if you've ever been to these theme parks, I mean, all the restaurants, if you go to Universal Studios, there's like Moe's in the Simpsons area, and there's a Krusty Burger van, so there's almost certainly at Star Wars World going to be a cantina restaurant.
Yeah.
You'd be mental not to.
There might be the Outlander nightclub from Attack of the Clones right in there.
Someone comes up and tries to sell you death sticks.
Exactly, yeah.
That's another thing. It's like, just, I'm going to slightly sidetrack here. When I went to Secret Cinema, there's a guy, like an alien guy, when you go in, and because you arrive on a ship, there's a whole role-play thing, you're in your costume and you turn up. And there was a guy on the door, and he gives you loads of hassle and grief and asks to see your papers. And he goes, show me your identification. And I did the whole hand wave and said, you don't need to see my identification. And he didn't play along with it. He went, yes, I do. Show me your identification. I was like, no, hang on a minute. Hang on. I'm clearly dressed as a Jedi. Throw me a bone here. Give me something to work
with. David Brent goes to Star Wars.
it's like, come on, play your role. To which he probably should have said, I'm a Tonarian. My tricks don't work on me. But he didn't. It's possible we've gone off track. Let's steer it back.
What were we talking about?
It's hard to say.
We were talking about the Caddyshack restaurant.
Yes.
But we've done that now. So should we talk about the new issue of Empire?
We can only talk a little bit about the new issue of Empire because it remains a Christmas secret.
It does.
Some of it.
Okay.
We can tease, show a bit of its ankle, should we say.
Okay. Yes.
And we can say it's an amazing issue. It's on sale.
On the...
It's on sale next Thursday.
It's on sale next Thursday, he says. Next Thursday, which would be... Checks, phone, hang on. Thursday,
the 29th
of December 2016.
Exactly.
It will be on sale.
So you're in your post-turkey stupor.
That's right. You've recovered from your Christmas Day hedonism.
You've watched Mrs. Miracle on television.
You have. And possibly Love Actually.
It's not a spoiler to say that this is an absolute dozy of an issue. I really love it.
I haven't read it yet. It's more of a doozy than dozy, but I'll you know, it's not boring.
Yeah, doozy, dozy.
So
whatever.
I think what we can say is that it's kind of... One of the things leading it off is the preview.
Yes.
There's a 2017 preview with a fantastic image of King Kong Skull Island.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
And basically any film you should see in 2017 is in this preview. Nick DeSamlin busted his ass getting a heroic amount of exclusives into it. It's very much worth reading. It is in many ways your essential guide to next year.
Yes. So and I did an interview with the director of the most essential film of next year.
Oh, did you?
Wow.
Really? Mm. I thought you said you didn't know anything about the Emoji Movie.
Boom. Very good.
Other great things in that issue. Chris Shewitt, who usually kind of tits about in here, done a couple of fantastic things. He's done a great interview with Cameron Crowe
for
Jerry Maguire, which is kind of taking you through all the kind of classic beats of Jerry Maguire and getting Crowe to talk about it. He also got together Walter Hill, the director of The Driver, and Edgar Wright, the director of Baby Driver, to talk about Hill's 1978 classic, The Driver. And that's a fantastic read. That's terrific.
This is like the spiritual successor to our French Connection piece, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, where Chris Hewitt gets an older filmmaker and a newer filmmaker and gets them to talk great stuff.
And has to pick up the lunch check.
Yes, it's absolutely fantastic. It's a brilliant read.
Those three things you've just mentioned are absolutely magic.
And
all
they're
of them.
Not even the main event, but we can't tell you what that is.
There's so much more.
So
stumble out after you finish watching your terrible Christmas movies.
Yes.
And
pick it up
next Thursday.
And we will give you more details in the next podcast in the new year, but you will have it by then anyway.
So that'd be pointless.
So that will be.
But we'll do it anyway. But we will do. Being pointless has never stopped us. Should we have a guess?
Go for it.
You may know this week's guest best as Eric Lenshear, Magneto himself. You may know him as an uncannily intense Steve Jobs in the movie the same name, or Prometheus's android David. If you're a really long-term fan of his, you may know him as the bloke in the background in Band of Brothers. But things have never been better for Michael Fassbender. He's got two Oscar nominations to his name, his pick of plum roles, and no one has mentioned his penis in a public forum for a good 2 years now. And as Alien Covenant, that we've already mentioned, and his new movie, Assassin's Creed, prove, he's so good they're casting him in movies twice now. We went along and had a chat with the man himself.
Oh, I had a run here, so I'm a bit out of breath. I didn't parkour. I should have parkoured here. I should have taken a leaf out of your book.
Up to the fifth floor.
Yeah.
In Claridge's.
Through the window. Set up my equipment in one fell swoop. Yeah, that's what would happen. Look at the state of me. I couldn't get 2 feet off the ground. Okay. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by Michael Fassbender, star and producer of Assassin's Creed. How are you, sir?
I'm great, man. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I don't even remember. The last time I saw you, you were just about to start, I think, the final intense preparation for this. We shared a flight back from X-Men Apocalypse.
That's right.
To London, and you were whisked off to Pinewood.
Yes.
To start this movie. At what point were you in that preparation? Had you fully parkoured? Had you fully become one with that technique?
I definitely sort of had my introduction to it. You know, there were so many things going on still while I was in Montreal. It was sort of script stuff, the parkour element, just the sort of in general sort of physical conditioning. But yeah, I mean, I was sort of already, you know, deep in it. I mean, I have been deep in it for 5 years, really. It was 2011 when I first met the guys from Ubisoft. We didn't have a script then, and we just sort of started from scratch. Plus the fact that we were developing brand new characters and a brand new regression timeline. We didn't want to take anything that was already in the gaming universe.
Of course, yeah.
Because we kind of wanted to set up our own camp outside of that. So everything was from scratch.
That's amazing. So it's been 5 years. So I guess at that point when you were being whisked away to start the final countdown to filming, was there a bit of a pinch me moment? This is actually, Jesus, this is happening.
It was just, you know, not even the time to do that, to be honest. It was just, it was all encompassing, you know. Like I say, if I wasn't working on script elements, I was doing the parkour, I was, you know, just physical conditioning, then I was jumping straight in with the stunts, the fight choreography, you know, discussions with Justin. It was really all immersive, so I didn't even have a chance to stop and go, we're filming it. There were moments where I thought, inevitably, you know, you think, wow, we're physicalizing this now. This was sort of a brain bubble at one point, and now here we are. In Malta and 40 degree heat and running on the roofs in Valletta. So it was,
in those clothes.
That's a nice moment, you know, when that happens. In those clothes. Fantastic costume, though, I gotta say. And not only does it look great, it was very user-friendly in terms of, you know, what we had to do sort of physically in the fights and the parkour, the running. It was as comfortable as it can be, but hot. I mean, I think I drank like 10 litres of water and I never went to the toilet. So that gives you an idea of what was going on.
Is that because you had a special pouch in your costume?
That's because I had the special pouch, the catheter.
The assassin's catheter.
Yeah, it's key. Not many people know that, but every assassin's got a catheter. Can't stop. You don't have time to pee.
Precisely. These guys have got to be lying in wait for maybe, what, hours? Sometimes days.
That's right.
You can't give yourself away.
That's right. You have to poop yourself. And you got to do it in plain sight.
I just hope that you're not downwind or upwind or whatever
right.
It is.
That would give you away, actually.
That would absolutely
just when everything
away.
Was going well, it was... that odor, which gave the assassin away.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Oh, yeah, Fassbender's in the vicinity again. but he's around. So the costumes for this were designed by Sammy Sheldon.
Yeah, fantastic.
You'd worked with her before.
That's right.
She worked in X-Men.
X-Men First Class, yeah. So talented. And again, you know, we had references from the games in terms of the costume, but you know, to translate them onto a sort of, you know, a cinematic scale is a difficult thing to do. And she kept a sort of, you know, a DNA, if you like, of the mm-hmm. costumes, but then came up with her own sort of flair on it. She did a great job.
So, obviously, you'd worked with Justin Kurzel before.
Yeah.
Were you cherry-picking people from your career? Is that basically what you'd be working with people and you'd go, maybe one day.
Yeah.
Get Assassins off the ground.
Yeah, well, we were kind of halfway through Macbeth, and I just thought, this guy is a perfect fit. I just thought, I was witnessing what he was doing with the resources that we had on Macbeth and how he could stretch them. And his relationship with Adam Arkapaw, the DP, a very special one. Just the realism that Justin brings to anything that he embarks on. Well, certainly with the experience that we had in Macbeth, he was very conscious of not having a theatrical version of it, to ground it very much in a realism. And his relationship to violence and the way he depicts it on screen, I knew... he's a very visceral filmmaker. So I knew it would lend very well to this world.
You weren't necessarily a fan of the game. You weren't even really aware of it that much, were you?
I wasn't, other than the posters and the stuff that I'd seen on TV, you know, in terms of trailers for the game. And I, you know, it did catch my eye, I have to say. I was quite intrigued by it, and there was an element of danger and mystery to it that... that definitely caught my eye. But other than that, I was totally ignorant. And and it was just the one lunch meeting I had with Ubisoft. They started to explain it to me, you know, the world of Templars, you know, what they stand for, this elite group of people in the world who are very powerful and very, very wealthy and essentially run the world.
Yeah.
And they believe in science and order. And they also believe that some humans are more valuable than others. And in fact, some should be enslaved. And then the flip side of that, you've got assassins who believe that free will should be maintained and protected at all costs. Mm-hmm. And actually the original assassins are Adam and Eve, who basically took free will and took that choice to pluck the apple off the tree. And in doing so, started this whole war between these two ideologies. I was like, wow, that's a really... interesting conflict and very interesting sort of ideologies at play there, and that that these two groups would be sort of battling it out for the future of humanity. I thought that's going to be cool. And then the Animus, this sort of, I've been calling it sort of genetic DeLorean. It's like this sort of genetic time machine that will allow us to explore different times in history. And you know, within this case, it's the Spanish Inquisition, and it's kind of, again, fun to sort of manipulate our understanding of what was happening then. So what seems to be, appears to be some form of religious cleansing is actually got more political intrigue behind in the background between Templars and Assassins. And then the element of parkour. You know, that I knew that would lend itself very, very well to action sequences.
Absolutely.
Especially, you know, the way that we went about filming them too. You know, Justin Kurzel, again, bringing this realism to his work, and we discussed it, that it was very important for us to do this in an old school sort of way. But that was really his vision, that you know, we were, you know, in an era, you know, nowadays we see a lot of these kind of genre films that saturated with CGI and special effects. So we wanted to go back to basics and have real people fighting in real locations, hanging off buildings, jumping from building to building, with very little green screen. And that was very rewarding to do, but it was quite a challenge.
How much of it did you do yourself?
I did 95% of the fighting myself, and then in terms of the leaps and the jumps, as much as I could do and was allowed to do, really.
Yeah.
We did lose quite a few stunt personnel along the way, to be honest, through broken ankles, leg injuries.
Jeez.
So it was pretty, it was pretty brutal at times.
Wow. So you got a head for heights?
You know, it's funny, I've got a head for heights outside, but when we were doing stuff in the studio, I realized that I get kind of jittery. We'd set up these sort of scaffolded sort of platforms that would have been sort of maybe this height and half again. Lucky we're on radio, people can see what I'm talking about. So maybe like 8 meter high sort of platforms were erected, and okay. when I was standing on them, I got a little freaked out. Actually, the fact yeah. that I think maybe the flooring underneath me wasn't totally stable or something, wow. but I was fine way up in the top buildings in Valletta.
Really?
Yeah.
Even you obviously had a cable. I'm guessing.
I have a cable. Yeah, yeah. for sure. Yeah,
that's definitely. The big thing. No yeah. cable, and it's like, no, you're not getting me up there.
Yeah, but even on the cables in the indoor, it was just the relationship that I had, I think, with what I was standing on. Yeah. That sort of freaked me out. Also doing some of the, you know, an abstergo when I'm on the arm and I'm doing the nosedive towards the floor, mm. the ground. That took a little bit of nerve. The first jump was always a little, you know, bit of a sphincter moment. I was sort of, you know, okay, hopefully the guy that's got me on the other end's not going to let me nosedive in the ground. But they're, you know, we're the best people in the business doing it. So,
but obviously you said you weren't a fan of the game when you were first told about it, really, by Ubisoft. Are you a fan of games at all? Are the things that you play?
I am a fan of them. It's just, you know, the thing is...
You're busy.
I mean, it's not to say that other people don't have free time. It's just I've got other hobbies that I'm desperately trying to improve on. And whenever I have time off, I kind of invest in those.
Okay.
But, I can be sucked into a game pretty easily. But then I realize that I'll have to spend many hours before I get good at it.
So you basically die in the first 20 minutes of Assassin's Creed every time you play it.
Yeah, I can't keep running up the same wall. I'm like, no, we know this doesn't lead anywhere.
That's pretty much me. That's pretty much me.
What turn somebody... around. Somebody attacking you or whatever.
I can barely turn on the Xbox, in fairness.
Yeah, so, I'm pretty yeah. sort of bad. I'm a technophobe all around, really.
What are some of the hobbies you're trying to improve? Are you trying to improve your golf swing? What are you...
I've given up on.
Okay.
I was a caddy for 4 years, so I understand the ins and outs of the games. I just don't think I've got the correct temperament for...
You were a caddy for 4 years?
I was, yeah.
Okay.
Between the ages of 12 and 16.
Who did you caddy for?
Oh, just golfers, really, mainly.
It tends to be golfers. Mainly golfers. Fairness, Michael.
You know, anybody that came to Killarney Links Golf Course.
How did that happen? Was I just get some pocket money for the weekends?
Yeah, yeah. It was a you know, holiday weekend job. Uh-huh. You know, you'd sit in the caddy shed and there was card playing and then you just sort of sit and wait until you get sort of called out. There was a list, priority list. I started off as a junior caddy, and by the time I finished, I was a senior caddy. it was a good education. £8 a round for a junior caddy and £12 a round for a senior.
That's not bad.
Yeah, back in whatever that was, 92 or something like that.
Yeah, but that was never the call in. There was never a chance that you might be caddying. You might see you on the TV with Rory McIlroy.
You know, that could
choosing
be fun.
The clubs.
I have thought about that whenever I watched golf. I was like, well, I wonder if I could continue down there.
They should have some sort of pro-am Assassin's Creed tournament where you could team up with, you know, celebrity gamers.
I did caddy in a pro-am. The guy that I caddied for came second in the pro-am, actually.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
This is amazing. I did not know this about you.
Yeah.
The secret caddying past
yeah.
of Michael.
But Fonsby. I'm an awful golfer. I always send the ball off to the right. I'm always playing on the other course. So I'm always playing on, like, you know, if I'm on the seventh, I'm playing on the one that's parallel to it.
That's a bad one.
Yeah, I'm always on my own. I'm okay. I'm over here.
It's a solitary pursuit. It's not good. And just one last thing. I mean, as this is a new path for you in terms of Assassin's Creed and
yeah.
looking at the future as well, is Magneto in your past? I mean, X-Men Apocalypse came out this year. Is that it for you in terms of those movies?
I don't know, to be honest. You know, I haven't made any sort of decision on it because I have no idea what's happening next with the franchise, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just one very, very last quick thing. I noticed throughout the movie, we won't give too much away, but I noticed throughout the movie that people keep telling you that the Apple is great.
Mm. The Apple is everything.
Important. Now, as a man who's played Steve Jobs,
yeah.
is that important to you?
Apple is everything, man.
The Apple is everything.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Alan Turing, you know, so many apples.
It's a recurring motif.
Yeah, yeah. I had apple juice this morning, actually.
Well, there you go.
Just to prepare myself.
Just to cleanse. Just in case you have to stand in the corner for 4 hours.
Exactly.
And wait for someone. All right, brilliant. Michael, it's been a pleasure.
Cheers,
thank
man.
You so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Cheers.
That was Michael Fassbender. Right, should we have some film reviews?
Yes.
We've got a few to get through. Let's get cracking with the new Will Smith movie, Collateral Beauty. It's been getting a bit of a pounding. Ian, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I saw it and it is getting a pounding. It's kind of getting kind of a...
Deservedly?
it's a poor film. It is a poor film. Basically, Smith plays an advertising executive who's grieving the loss of his daughter, and he writes letters to the Free Abstracts, Love, Death and Time. Now, his work colleagues notice this, intercept the letters and hire actors, played by Helen Mirren, Keira Knightley and Jacob Lattimore, to become these Free Abstracts and interact with him.
Right.
Thus sort of giving him life lessons about where he's going wrong.
Right.
There's some nice performances. Helen Mirren plays Death, and she gives it some nice sort of zhuzh. It's kind of a twinkly, it looks kind of twinkly and New York-y, but to be honest with you, it doesn't work. It's kind of mechanically done. It has subtlety of a sledgehammer. And Smith is really, I mean, obviously his character's grieving, so he's morose, but he never really ever comes to life. He's kind of sleepwalking through the whole movie. So if you've ever seen 7 Pounds, it's kind of that's Will Smith, yeah, as opposed to the Hitch Will Smith.
Low energy kind of.
Yeah,
plotting.
Really. Yeah, it's that kind of thing. So that's the sort of thing you'd expect to see on Channel 5 in the afternoon. I think there's kind of, you know, it wants to be a heartwarming Christmas film, and it really isn't.
Right.
So 2 stars from Empire.
So next year, next Christmas for the in-laws, that will be a purge mechanism.
That's a good shout.
Right. What do you think Will... I mean, Suicide Squad obviously was a bit of a hit, and he had a prominent role in it, but what do you think Will Smith needs now to really kind of revitalise himself in his
career? It's interesting that he chose not to do the Independence Day reboot. Now, maybe in hindsight, that's a good move in terms of what happened to it, but you would think something that people find him, you know, beloved in.
A bit fun.
So something fun would be good.
Yeah, I think they both probably would have benefited from.
Yeah, and he has been. That. He can do serious. You think of him in Ali and other things. And
Pursuit of Happiness.
And he can do that kind of thing. So, hopefully, he'll come good soon.
Cool. So we've given that 2 stars.
Yep.
For Collateral Beauty. Next one up is another pair of movie stars, Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. There was a lot of talk about passengers having these massive paychecks attached to it.
But it's interesting. This film is also getting a bit of a critical kicking.
That's an understatement.
And it seems, again, it doesn't warrant it. It really doesn't.
I'm defending this one. If one goes onto Rotten Tomatoes, you will see me standing alone on a hill amidst a sea of sort of marauders. I gave this film 4 stars, Passengers, and I really, really liked it. I seem to be in the minority, but if you have a soul... you should agree with me. That's my position on this.
So what's the setup?
Let's talk about this. Yeah. This is a film that's been floating around for ages. It was on the blacklist in 2007. And it is it's directed by Morten Tilden of Imitation Game fame.
Yep, Headhunters.
Indeed. And it stars Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence as, for all intents and purposes, the last two human beings alive. Essentially, they're on a colony ship. Heading from Earth to New Earth, like a new home where they're going to set up shop.
Homestead 2.
Homestead 2, and given the state of the world at the moment, I shall be joining them next time it sets sail. And the journey takes 120 years. So it's not a red eye. It's a long journey. And they're all in hibernation for the duration, except they wake up early. And with 90 years left to go on the clock, they are the only two people on this ship. Now, there is much more to the story than that, but that is all I can say without ruining the film. But it becomes, and I said this in the review, to my mind, a very, very traditional romance film. You know, they fall in love, they go on dates, you know, they have dinner, they go to the movies, you know.
Yeah.
It's an interesting evolution of their relationship from strangers to partners. And I really like... I really love it. I thought the two of them are adorable there. I mean, they are second only to Gosling and Stone in my eyes for on-screen chemistry. And I found it very touching, and I thought it had an emotional honesty to it. And again, the reasons for that are difficult to go into, but there is a lot more to their relationship. It's not entirely based on honesty, and there are some dark secrets sort of floating below the surface. And I thought that particular aspect of it had an emotional honesty that Pratt in particular played very well. And I won't say this is like the best he's ever been, but I think it showed more range for him than you see in most of his films, in that he played it quite quiet and quite still and quite conflicted and quite tortured. And I very much enjoyed that. This uses the Titanic paradigm in that it's part love story, part disaster movie. And obviously there's lots and lots of things with the ship that they have to fix, and there's excitement in there as well.
There's fantastic stuff. She goes swimming.
Yes.
And the anti-grav goes.
That's right. zero degree nearly drowning is quite full on.
Yeah.
It takes infinity pool to a whole new...
I kind of preferred the first half when they're dating. Yeah. I think the second half is a little bit shonky for me.
Oh, I enjoyed the second half stuff. I thought it was very good. And but I get your point. And I really enjoyed Michael Sheen as the robot bartender.
Yeah.
He's loads of fun.
Yeah, so I was on set of this movie.
Yeah.
And I was at the scene, their first date... And there's a lot more to that when they go on their date. They have a conversation about what they call their autobiographies, and all that's gone. It's a fun scene to watch, and it's a shame that some of that's gone.
It seems that this film has generated a lot of hate, and I'm not entirely sure that any of it was warranted. It's the new Love Actually, perhaps.
Maybe.
I thought it was fantastic. I think definitely go and see it. The performances are great. There's lots to love here. It's not just sappy romance. There's lots of other stuff in there as well. But, you know...
There's a lot of filmmaking craft as well. If you're into cinematography and visual effects.
It's beautiful. Beautifully shot. And the set design is fantastic.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Designed that.
But just to continue the Titanic thing, it feels a lot like that to me. Like Titanic was like roundly panned by everyone in terms of people like backlashed against it almost instantly and then went and saw it three or four times.
Yeah.
You know, and it strikes me as that kind of film where maybe if people like it, they don't want to say they like it. I don't know. Go and see it.
It's also a great idea at the centre, isn't it? That do we fall in love with people because we fall in love with them innately or do we fall in love with people just because of convenience?
Yeah, because they're the only person alive.
And proximity.
Yeah.
And that's a nice idea for a film, I think. And the film does a good job of exploring that.
Yeah, but if you could watch it and then say how great it is, it would certainly make me feel a lot better standing alone as I am on this hill.
At James Dyer.
Yeah, thanks. Tweet me and tell me you liked it.
Got any warm words for Prometheus as well? Now might be the time. Next up, it's not Christmas without a devout slice of Catholic guilt from Martin Scorsese. Ian Freer, tell us about Silence.
Merry Christmas, hooray, everyone. Yeah. So this is Scorsese's passion project. Been on the cards for almost 30 years, I think. It's set in 17th century Japan. It's two Jesuit priests, played by Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver. They set out to find Father Ferreira, played by Liam Neeson, who's their mentor, and he's kind of gone missing and reputedly committed apostasy, which is renouncing his faith. So they go off in a mission like Apocalypse Now and try and find him. And
Apostasy Now.
Yes, exactly. And they kind of get sidetracked on the way, getting involved with the secret Christians in Japan. And it's a very serious film. It's beautiful to look at. It's by the cinematographer of Passengers, who had a great week this week, Rodrigo Prieto. And it's a very challenging film. It's a long film. It's kind of very serious, and but deeply, deeply kind of moving and spiritual and full of big ideas. And if you stick with it, it pays you back. I think it's terrific.
It sounds like an incredibly kind of like a film you need to let it wash over you. Just go with it.
It's a film that you kind of need to stick with in a way. It's not an easy watch. Basically, in the second half, Driver and Garfield get separated, and there are scenes that the kind of the journey of Garfield's faith plays out in scenes that become very similar, and some people might lose patience with that. But it ends in a way you wouldn't suspect, and I think it's terrific. It's
Now, when the trailer for this film came out, there was lots of shall we say back talk about the various accents. I believe reading someone said that it felt like it was the character select screen on Super Mario Kart. is that something that's an issue or
that's never an issue for me. I think
it's semi-Andrew Garfield.
it's not that or it's not Adam Driver's not like that, but there's some great Japanese actors in this as well, so that kind of stuff's done all very sincerely. And I think it's a tough start to the new year, but a very, very strong one.
Good stuff.
And we've given that 4 stars for Silence.
4 stars.
And lastly, almost lastly, A Monster Calls, which I saw a little while back and loved. It's Juan Antonio Bayona, of course, of the Impossible fame, and it's an adaptation of, I guess, it's a somewhere between child and young adult fantasy, illustrated fantasy novel. I guess that's important because if you're going to have a criticism of this film, which is about death and grief and loss, and it's quite confronting in the way that it portrays it with a sort of Pan's Labyrinth creature at its core, this tree monster who befriends a boy who's facing up to the potential loss of his mother, played by Felicity Jones,
and it's that it's it, it there's not a lot of comfort in this film.
I don't think it's a child's film at all.
No,
it's a great. It's this film. Patrick Ness's novel is kind of might be a
yes,
kind of somewhere in between that children and young adult thing. I just think this is a film for grown-ups.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think let's come on to that in a sec. But I think first of all, it's a really moving, emotional piece of work.
Yeah,
and it is a film that really tackles you know, grief and loss head on without using, you know, euphemisms or metaphors. It really just comes at it confrontingly. A little bit like Manchester by the Sea. It's very moving. It's quite a quiet film in some ways, but it explodes into these big kind of visual fantasy segments where the boy who's terrifically played, a terrific newcomer, Lewis McDougall, basically encounters Liam Neeson, the Liam Neeson tree monster, who takes him and tries to teach him sort of important lessons. I don't want to get into the particulars of that because
it's a film about storytelling as well,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Giving too much away, it gets into the nature of that.
Yeah, it is. I thought it was really lovely. 4 stars we gave that one. But yeah, going back to who it's for, I guess that's the challenge.
I think Del Toro is a good reference point for it. If you're into that sort of mixture of fantasy and grown-upness, then I think, you know.
Yeah. I was going to say, Pan's Labyrinth is one you really can't take kids to because it's an incredibly violent... It's an incredibly violent film at times, although it has this kind of Tolkien fantasy at its core. This one, I think, you probably could take, you know, maybe not your youngest, but you could take your kids to, potentially. But you'd be looking at sitting down with them for a good hour and a half afterwards and just talking them down from...
Yeah, be prepared to have some tough conversations, I think, you know, once you're done.
But, you know, I think maybe kids can handle it. But it is a beautiful film for adults. I think some people are saying it's not for kids, it's not for adults, but I would really disagree with that. I think it's really, really, really heartfelt and emotional and visually interesting as well. Mm. And I love Felicity Jones in it. Lewis McDougall, I thought, was really good as the kid. There's some nice turns as well from Sigourney Weaver as the kind of mother-in-law, and Toby Kebbell as well, who's the dad, estranged dad.
And Bayona's directing the new Jurassic World movie, isn't he? So that's all power to him.
There you go.
Right.
So we gave A Monster Calls 4 stars. And just to round up the also outs this week, we've got Bryan Cranston, James Franco rom-com, which makes it sound like they're...
James Franco is marrying into Bryan Cranston's family, and Bryan Cranston's a kind of conservative dad, and James Franco's a wacky young guy, and he's trying to over impress him.
Right, so sort of
hijinks ensue.
Right, hijinks, not Jinx the cat.
No.
Okay, Meet the Parents overtures there, but we've given that 2 stars,
yep.
So not quite on that level. And we've also got Liam Neeson in his third cameo in the podcast.
The hardest
minutes.
Working man in show business, huh?
Yeah, and he's in Operation Chromite. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he plays General MacArthur, he's a very kind of typically Neeson-esque gravitas performance. But I think the better thing in the movie is the kind of the cast around him. I think they give it some interest. So 3 stars from Empire.
Perfecto, and that is my word.
Maybe what? We should maybe mention, is it Boxing Day, the release of Assassin's Creed, which we're not going to be there.
That's correct.
We're not going to be there to review, so we should probably mention Assassin's Creed, which will be out. It is Boxing Day, isn't it, Ian? Is it Boxing Day?
I think it's the 1st of Jan.
I think it's the 1st of Jan.
Let's check it.
It's not Boxing Day, it's New Year's Day. Nevertheless,
it's in that ballpark.
It's in between now and when we'll have the next podcast. So let's this is the film that reunites Marion Cotillard, director Justin Kersal, and for Assassin's Creed Bender, the all-star team behind Macbeth, for the adaptation of the Ubisoft game, which is about a modern-day, death row criminal, let's be honest, who gets saved from the needle at the last minute and taken to a special secret facility where he is catapulted back in time to relive the experiences of his ancestors via the miracle of genetic memory. Carl Jung would be very, very proud. It makes no sense in terms of actual science. But yeah, this is based on the very successful series of games, of which there isn't one this year, interestingly. And it's very much an action film, sort of part period, part modern. It's interesting from a tonal perspective because they've gone for a very serious take.
Dour, almost.
Yeah. And given, and I won't give away too much, but given the plot and given the fantastical MacGuffin at the centre of it, a sense of humour probably wouldn't have gone amiss. But yes, and the sections, when he goes back to sort of Constantinople, sort of Renaissance era, and does lots of parkour, leaping around on rooftops. And the sort of past sections are all subtitled. They're all in Italian, presumably for authenticity. And I think that doesn't necessarily help that they're being, you know, very, very serious, but they're also doing it in Italian.
Yeah, but within those sections, there's some really good action.
There is. And I think this is the whole film's saving grace. I mean, I very much enjoyed it. I've played all of the games to date, so I was very au fait with the plot as it developed. But the whole point of Assassin's Creed, it's running on rooftops, it's acrobatics, it's, you know, lots and lots of elaborate martial arts, and they pull it off really, really well. There's some excellent choreography. There's some incredible invention in some of the action as well. There's a bit where, you know, he can't get a clear shot with a bow, so he fires an arrow off the wall and ricochets it into someone's head, which is genius. He does a wall run flip while on the back of a chariot, sort of like charging down a street. I mean, there's tons of great stuff in there. And you know, fair play to Kurzel as well. I mean, if anyone's played the games, when the future person goes back in time, he essentially lies down on a bed, and that's your future action sequence. It's not the most dynamic, and instead they've created the Animus as this sort of huge robotic arm that seizes Fassbender and sends him catapulting around this room. So it gives a real sort of visual dynamism to the future sections, which I think really, really helps the kind of counterpoint between those two eras as well. There's loads going on. Michael K. Williams is in there. Jeremy Irons is in there.
Brendan Gleeson turns up.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of good people in there. And I mean, look, this was the year where we thought that video game movies would finally, you know, seize the day. We'd have Warcraft, we had Assassin's Creed, and they were both nailed on, surefire, massive hits that were going to be amazing. Neither of them are. However, this is definitely, I would say, a step up from Warcraft. I think, you know, the plot is a little too po-faced, and it's, you know, again, if you haven't played the games, it's a little hard to follow. But it's really saved by the action, which is great, and the visuals. I mean, it gives you a real sense of place and of occasion in Constantinople, which I believe was shot in Malta.
Okay.
The Maltese Street.
It also is also a film that very confidently teases a sequel.
Yes, very, very confidently. And it may ultimately prove overconfidently, but yeah, it does. I think... yeah, there's a lot to be said about this in terms of how it was produced. I mean, I wasn't on set and I can't speak to any of that, but Ubisoft are very protective of this franchise, and I do wonder how much they mandated a lot of the content of this film. This is just my own personal speculation, but I found that quite interesting while watching the film. But hey, I would argue it is quite possibly the best video game adaptation to date. I appreciate that is not a particularly high bar to clear, but it's worth a look. It's, you know, it's fun. Again, this has had some mixed critical response. I'm on the more positive side of this one. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was worth a pump.
Cool.
So there you go.
Good stuff.
Assassin's Creed Bender.
And we've given that one...
we've given it 3 stars.
3 stars still. Right, that's it for the Empire Podcast. I know what you're thinking. It's sad. It's a sad moment.
It is sad.
Not just for this week, but obviously for the whole year.
Yeah.
It's been a wonderful year. Thanks for joining us along the way. We have one small exception to that, though. We have potentially a Rogue One spoiler special going up sometime around the New Year's mark.
Yes, I have to apologise for this.
Did it go up?
Yes, it went
previously.
Up. There was premature publication of the Rogue One spoiler special. Where
you
we
can
put
take
it
things
up.
To that, you know.
Yeah, we put it up on Monday this week, which was actually too early, so it has come down. And then I went on Twitter and said it'd be up on Boxing Day, which turns out was also wrong. So it's been a shit show from top to bottom.
Right.
But it will be the Rogue One spoiler special. If you didn't catch it when it leaked online briefly, if you didn't catch it, it will make a triumphant return on the 1st of January.
Yes.
I promise.
Yes.
I promise.
A great Gareth Edwards interview.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes.
Look at those full starts as a kind of a teaser for it, but only if you have
also,
the whole
it gives
movie.
You, it gives people a chance to see the film a couple of times.
Yeah,
and
really get into
board.
It. I mean, it is massively spoilersome. So, I mean, you definitely don't want to listen to it until you've seen it at least once, preferably twice. So, you know, get excited. It'll be back.
I've written down, trust us, it's unmissable. But I haven't actually listened to it yet because you took it down.
That's it.
Is
sorry,
that true?
Phil.
It sounds yeah. unmissable.
We yanked it. It was a bait and switch.
I haven't seen the film yet.
Yes.
Phil, you're the only person alive. Are you waiting for like the Polish edit? Is that what this is?
I'm waiting for this. The DVD has all the subtitles. Yes. I can watch it in any variety of intergalactic languages.
Right, that makes sense.
Also, I was moving house on the day that they screened it and I couldn't make it.
Right.
But I pretty much know what happens now. Thanks, guys.
But when the botchy edit is available, you'll be the first.
I'll be the first in line.
Okay.
So we'll be back next year, I believe.
We will.
Unless they take our microphones away for more film-related fun. And we hope you'll join us then. Thank you again for all your ears this year. And check back on January the 6th for our regular podcast, the first of 2017. And don't forget to have a listen to our big 2016 podcast roundup, where we talk about literally everything.
The Review of the Year podcast.
But it's all good.
Which will be live on, I can't remember. I genuinely can't remember.
Utter shambles.
I know. Scheduling things. I'm dreadful at podcast scheduling, as has become abundantly clear. So it'll be up at some point, probably before the Rogue One. Why don't you? It'd be like a Christmas present. You won't know when it'll arrive. You don't know when Santa's coming.
You know exactly when Christmas presents are going to arrive.
Yeah, all right,
exactly.
Fair enough. But you don't know what he's bringing you. In this case, it's the reverse. You do know what we're bringing. You just don't know when we're bringing it. Am I stretching this analogy?
Don't ever go into the advent calendar business, James. I have like four doors and one broken
They'll
window.
They'll all be wrong.
They're all wrong. All singing, all dancing, 2016 big movie roundup. And that's going to be a lot of fun. Until then, and until next year, it's goodbye from James.
Goodbye. See you on the flip side.
It's goodbye from Ian.
Merry Christmas, folks.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to complete my roundup of Christmas cards with the munch scream emoji and the words "I'm screaming of a white Christmas" beneath that. Merry Christmas, one and all. Thanks for joining us.